Welcome back to another episode of Feel Good Life. I'm Jennifer James, your host. I'm excited to be here with two very important folks in the rice industry and two folks that I can say I have been good friends with for a long time. I worked together on many different things in the rice industry, but today we have Riceland's CEO, Kevin McGilton, and Riceland's Executive Vice President, Chief Operating Officer, Ben Noble. So welcome, guys. Glad to have you here.
Thanks, Jennifer.
Yeah, appreciate it, Jennifer. Appreciate you having us on.
Let's just start out by letting both of you just introduce yourselves. Tell us a little bit about your work history, especially when it comes to rice, and maybe a few facts about you that might be interesting for our listeners.
All right, I'll jump in first, I guess, Ben. Again, Kevin McGilton, President, CEO of Riceland Foods, as Jennifer said. I started in the rice industry in 1995, went to work for Louis Dreyfus. They had an export rice mill down in southeast Arkansas in the community of McGee. Worked there purchasing rough rice from farmers to run that mill. Also loaded rough rice barges for the export market. Then got a chance to go to Washington, D.C. 2001, 2002, worked for the USA Rice Federation, held the title of Director of Government Relations, got to lobby on the 2002 Farm Bill. I learned a lot in that process, of course, about policy and the way that impacts the agriculture industry. I got to meet all of the folks in the rice milling industry as well. Got to meet the team at Riceland, and when they found out I was from Arkansas, said, "You get ready to come home, let us know." And 2 years of D.C. is all a country boy needed. I made the call, came back home to Arkansas in 2003, went into the export sales department, spent the next 14 years traveling the world in Arkansas and Missouri rice. And then I got a chance to move back into the policy area in 2017, went to work in the government relations department here with Riceland. Years developed there, ended up in the chief of staff role, and then most recently got the promotion to the CEO role. So it's been a journey for sure. As they say, every crop's a little different, and we definitely see that in the rice business for sure. But obviously, Riceland is more than just a rice company. We're in the soybean market as well. So it's been interesting. You know, again, being from Arkansas, growing up in a rural setting, obviously I love to hunt. I love to fish. You know, anything outdoors, count me in. Kid Ben, I'm a retired golfer. I just had to give that up long ago. They keep trying to get me on the golf course, but that's just a tragedy waiting to happen. So I gave that up pretty quick.
Well, that's a great summary, Kevin. I'm Ben Noble, as you said, Executive Vice President, COO. I've been at Riceland now for 8 years. Prior to that, I'd say my family's history in the agricultural space goes back a pretty good time. We've been farming in East Arkansas since 1890, and I grew up about 30 miles south of one of our rice mills in Stuttgart. But I guess Kevin said Washington, D.C. only needed 2 years. I was a little slower than him. Took me longer to get my feel. I did my studies at the University of Arkansas, proud Razorback fan, but I made my way to Washington early in my career. Worked for a couple of members from Arkansas and the U.S. Senate. Spent some time working for trade associations as well, the cotton industry, the rice industry. But a lot of my professional time was focused in the public affairs space. I spent a great deal of time with that, and Riceland was a client of mine during most of that tenure. So I worked on policy formulation at the Senate level and through the private sector. And as I've shared about 8 years ago, they asked me to, kind of like Kevin, they asked me to come back home. And I've been proudly a part of the Riceland team ever since. And as our collective titles reflect, we wear a lot of different hats around this place. So as far as anything unique or particular, proud to share. My son he's at the U of A following in dad's footsteps. And I'll put this one out on the podcast. If you go to Washington this summer, he's going to be interning for Senator. He's going to be interning for Senator John Bozeman there on the Senate Ag Committee. So we're keeping it all in the family. We've got our inside track on policy development with James. So we're counting on him delivering big things.
No pressure there, right?
That's right.
Well, that sounds like a great opportunity. And I know there's a lot of folks that go to D.C. and have those opportunities and those internships. So we see a lot of those folks come back in the state and plug back in, too. So that's a good thing for those young folks who are interested in agriculture, especially agriculture policy, to do. So good luck to James. Let's talk a little bit about Riceland, because that is what you guys have in common, and especially with me too. So as we know, and I'm sure a lot of my listeners know, Riceland is a farmer-owned cooperative and been around over 100 years. So the beginning of that predates all of us and most all of the listeners probably. Why are there farmer-owned cooperatives? It's not uncommon in agriculture to have a cooperative. You know, why do we have one? What's the purpose? What does Riceland do, and how do they serve their members? Can you talk a little bit about that, Kevin?
Yeah, Jennifer, I think the basis for farmer-owned cooperatives in general is to fill a gap in the marketplace. From Riceland's early beginnings, again, 1921, a crisis had developed in the rice industry. High prices during World War I, the government was buying a lot of rice, shipping it to troops overseas. And when the war ended, rice prices plummeted. Many farmers were going bankrupt during that period. Prices were $3.50 a bushel, went down to 30 cents a bushel. So a lot of economic stress. So a handful of farmers came together and said, you know, we've got to do something here to look out for ourselves. There was no rice cooperative at that time, brokers who were sending rice to New Orleans at that time. So the farmer was just really kind of out there on his own. He was buying seed at planting time when typically prices were really good. And then when it came time to sell his crop at harvest, prices would typically just plummet. So came together, they filled this gap, filled this need to look out for their interest. And I'd say here we are 100 years later, and that's what Riceland Foods continues to do. And I'd say that's what most farmer-owned cooperatives are doing, looking out for the interest of their members. As far as Riceland Foods, we're a traditional processing and marketing cooperative. We're taking our farmers' raw commodities, rice and soybeans, space we're playing in today, processing those commodities, turning them into a finished good and moving them into the marketplace, whether that's the domestic or international market. So every day we're milling rice, we're crushing soybeans. So we're taking rice bran, rice hulls, rice bran oils, soybean meal, soybean oil into the marketplace for our membership, and doing our best to return as much revenue back to them as absolutely possible.
I completely agree with everything you said. I think that at its core, you know, one of the things cooperatives offer is the ability for an entity to do collectively for what the farmers can't do individually. When he talks about, he shared the crisis that existed. You had, I think it's worth sharing this aspect of that story. The rice industry had started up in the 20s, and the legend goes that a lot of the farmers grew the crop. They were excited about the potential that industry had, but when they got thrown with harvest, they shipped all their product down to New Orleans, and they expected to get paid. And instead of getting paid, they ended up getting a bill for milling services. And they thought, well, this doesn't seem very That doesn't make for one heck of a business model. So they looked around. This is how I envision it. I don't know if this is actually how it happened, but just stick with me. They looked around and said, well, I don't have enough money to build a rice mill on my own. But, you know, Jennifer, you got a little money. How about you, Kevin? Let's all team together here and let's form a company where we add this value here in the state. Let's put some staff together that can market for us around the world. And that's what they did. Notably, they built the infrastructure that exists today, as Kevin referenced. We're tasked with processing their grain and then finding a market for it. And having them all band together like they did and continue to do allows us as their ambassadors to go out and make commitments to larger companies that you'd recognize, a Kellogg's, a Post, an Anheuser-Busch, a Mars, etc. Individual farmers wouldn't have the volume nor the capacity to do that on their own. And by banding together as a cooperative, it gives them that ability to service larger entities. And when we make profits as a cooperative, we give that back to the farmers. That's not just going to some Fortune 500, whatever the world, business structure. It's a unique business model, and it serves to the benefit of our membership.
And I think sometimes we as farmers look at, I plant my crop, I grow my crop, I harvest my crop, it's delivered, I'm done, I'm out. And we forget sometimes all that has to happen to those kernels of rice between when I unload my truck at the dryer or at the mill to when it actually reaches the plate or in as an ingredient, you know, and some of the ingredient, the flour, the oil, the soybean meal, things like that gets fed, you know, all that. So it's really easy for us to forget about that and go duck hunting and deer hunting and then start again. So thanks for reminding us about all that is done after harvest, because I think it's really important to keep it top of mind. Something else that Riceland does, I think is very important, is our government affairs offices, which both of you guys have had experience not only at Riceland, but outside of Riceland in government affairs. And so it's been really important over the years, the push that the rice industry has had, and I think in the last several years, really developed a very strong voice when it comes to DC. So how has Riceland participated in that and helped elevate that voice? We've gotten some things done here in the last few years for our farmers. And how have y'all provided that support for our members and really the rest of the industry has benefited from the government affairs at Riceland?
Well, I'll jump in there, Ben, and I guess maybe start with the history of it. No, the predecessor here, Bill Reed, worked in the government affairs space for well over 30 years. I believe he came to Riceland in the late 70s. And at that time, Dick Bell was the CEO. Dick was the Undersecretary of Agriculture. I believe he was in the Nixon administration, if I'm remembering correctly. So he had close ties to Washington. He understood how critical ag policy was to the industry. So he made sure Riceland had a robust government affairs program. And then when Bill Reed retired, I took that spot and worked it. Again, I think we just see that ag policy and farming in the United States are just really tied at the hip. Ag policy being the safety net, if you will, to protect farmers when prices fall, and being part of that farm bill voice out there, if you will, to make sure that those policy needs, that safety net need that's there, to make sure that's part of the conversation is critical. And farmer-owned cooperatives can play a key role there because we are so close to our membership. We understand those needs probably better than any organization out there.
Well, and the fact that we're, you know, Riceland, rice is in the name. Rice, when you look around the world, rice is probably the most politically sensitive crop that there is. Sugar may be a close second. But what do I mean by that? I mean, everywhere around the world that they grow rice, the governments that exist want to make sure there's a domestic supply available. And government affairs can take on any number of things. And Kevin and I just this morning were talking about health care. You've got immigration. You've got trade policy, et cetera. But at its core, what this cooperative, think about it, we started in 1921 and shortly thereafter was the Great Depression, formulated the first farm bill, which is that domestic support, making the commitment of the U.S. government to sustain a domestic food supply. Kevin gives great history back to the 70s. I think that you know, I would take it even further. Well, Riceland's been involved in ensuring that we've got a strong safety net that provides for a domestic food supply for a long time. And that's been a critical role that we have played. And gosh, the amount of time Kevin and I and the rest of the staff around here spend on government affairs may shock some people, because whether it's trade agreements, tax policy, farm bill, or anything in between, it's critical to our farmers' ability to be viable on a daily basis.
For sure. Absolutely agree. And it is surprising when you start paying more attention to all those other topics you mentioned, too. It's not just farm bill. And there's a lot of other things that affect our operations, that the milling operations, you know, the whole industries. It's good that we've got folks that's what they're 100% focused on. And I think farmers have seen the benefit of that focus, too. But we've also had some tough years here on the farm. We're experiencing going into 25, doesn't look all that great. High input costs, low prices. In the last few years, though, the diversity in Riceland's footprint in Arkansas and Missouri has allowed farmers to shift, grow some other crops that might have been more profitable. Also, although rice is still our bread and butter, you know, we all call ourselves rice farmers, I think, here in Arkansas for sure. But now the other crops don't look good either. We don't really have a choice in 25 that's very profitable. And then there's some other things that have happened. You know, in 2022, I know in my part of Arkansas, we had some really high temperatures during corn pollination. We got hit on some corn yields. We've had some early soybeans the last few years. I've had some damage in that soybean crop. Those are, you know, reductions in the income to the farm. And something I think we have to address and talk a little bit about today is milling quality. And this is not a new issue. This isn't just a 24 crop issue. This is something that's been being discussed within the industry, all the states, for I'd say 8-10 years now. We've been talking about quality milling issues in rice. So I just would love to hear what y'all's thoughts are on the quality issue of milling in the Mid-South region, and where do we go from here? You know, your thoughts.
Yeah, I'll start on that one, Ben, and let you fill in. Yeah, I think what we've seen on milling quality, I guess I'll probably take it all the way back to about 2010, is when we had new varieties coming online, hybrid varieties came online, and it was really a push for greater yield, right? I mean, if we want to talk about farming and keeping farming viable, any crop you want to talk about, whether it's corn, soybeans, rice, cotton, field yield is critical, right, to getting that revenue that the farmer needs. And I think what we saw with new varieties coming on board as we come to today, and it's not just hybrids, it's even the conventional varieties today. I think in that breeding process, that push to get higher yield, I believe we left some quality milling traits that were in some of those older varieties. We left those traits behind in this push to get field yield. You know, the cooking characteristics of U.S. rice, I would say, have changed very little. The experience that our end consumers have with U.S. rice, I would say most rice consumers have recognized little change. But we definitely, for those of us in the milling industry, obviously Riceland Foods owns several rice mills. We're the largest rice miller in the United States. So the milling quality of rice is very important, and that yield that we can get out of that 100 pounds of rough rice that our members bring to us, that yield of what we would call fancy rice, which is the rice that we eat as rice consumers, that yield has continually to go down over the years, which means revenue to the farmer is lower, revenue to their cooperatives is lower. So it's had a big impact. And we've just seen that new varieties in recent years just seem to be very susceptible to environmental factors. If the rice dries down in the field, which traditionally years ago that was not a big issue, but in these newer varieties that they seem to need to be harvested at a higher moisture and not dry down in the field. So there's a lot of factors at play there. Obviously, as the rice farms have gotten bigger, Jennifer, it's hard to get the combine to all of the fields that are ready for harvest and get that rice out of there when it needs to get out, right? So there's some factors there of the size of farm, the time of harvest, and also these new varieties that we have. They just seem to be a little more tender, I guess you could say, and they just don't hold up as well as some of the varieties we've had in it.
Yeah, the only thing I would add to that, just for your listeners that may not get into some of those technical aspects, is at the end of the day, when you have rice that comes out of the field, you have to process it, and you want as much of that to be what we call fancy rice, which is if you go to the grocery store or you go to the restaurant, you're eating fancy rice. That's what we call fancy. It's the long grain or medium grain rice, and it's a nice, pretty long kernel. At least we think it's beautiful.
Yeah.
And what you don't want on your plate is what we call a bunch of brokens, which is a lot of that that's chopped up into little bitty bits, right? And the milling yield is how much of that long grain fancy can we get when it goes through that process that's unavailable for selling on the grocery store or the restaurant tables. And Kevin did a great job of walking you through the challenges we face, and it's been decades in the making, but that's we're not getting enough of that long grain fancy out of our milling processes right now. We've got a lot of brainstorming and investment to make from all of those involved in R&D and seed development, et cetera, to make sure that we stay on track for not only the agronomic practices that are needed for our farmers, but the economics of the underlying processing side that ends up having to market the crop.
Right. Poor milling hurts the farmer. It hurts the mills. It hurts the end product. So it's not just a farmer problem. And I think sometimes it feels like it is when you're the farmer, for sure. But so just, you know, the 24 crop felt, you know, like it was the worst one ever when it comes to milling. So we're, you know, the marketing year starts, what, August 1? So we're a little over halfway through the 24 crop. And from y'all's perspective, you know, y'all know what that rice mill's coming in. You know, with the farmers, we know what our milling yields were. And then y'all have seen the rice come through the mills. So what's that looking like on the output? And what are y'all seeing from how you estimate what's coming in to what's going out? And is there a big difference?
Yeah, Jennifer, unfortunately, what we've seen is the early estimates that we saw on milling yields as we run those bushels through these hundreds of millions of dollars of worth of rice mills that the cooperative owns. We're seeing the early estimates on those milling yields turn out to be true. We're just not getting the outturn on that rice that we've seen in previous years. And I think you're right. I've been in this business 30 years, and I would say this is the poorest milling crop I've seen in my 30-year career. So we're just not seeing that outturn that we traditionally see from rice. So it just has not been a good crop. I would like to tell you that, you know, the rice mills surprised us and we picked up a big yield in the mill that we didn't see in the early samples. But I'm afraid our rice mills are confirming that this is the poorest milling crop in at least the last 30 years.
Yeah, and the only thing I would add is that makes it more challenging if you're not getting as much fancy as you thought you were going to out of the process. Makes it challenging to fill the orders you've got for what we call fancy rice. And it also means you've got a lot more of that broken kernel that's around. And we're pleased that there's a market for that. But unfortunately, when supply and demand, we've definitely seen the value of those brokens go down because we've got we've had a glut of that during the course of the marketing year.
And so when you're planning, you know, obviously I would think you're planning, you're hoping for more fancy, just like we are, the farmer is. And so as you're making those sales, you know, and you end up with a year like this where you say, Ben, you have more brokens, I mean, what are the challenges there to be able to sell both parts of it and still remain profitable?
I'll take first shot at that. Yeah, when you're getting more, it's just manufacturing 101. You want to be as efficient as possible. So if you're having to run that equipment longer and harder to get the same amount of fancy as you would through a smaller amount of volume, then bottom line, your cost of goods goes up. So to achieve profitability for not only the co-op, but also for the farmer, short version is poor milling crops makes that a lot more difficult. And as I shared, supply demand, if you've got a lot larger supply of some of your byproducts, then some of the revenue streams that you had anticipating generating, they don't look as rosy as they did before. So you've got cost of goods up. You've got margins down, and there's a squeeze on profitability all around. But I'll stop there and let Kevin clean that up.
No, unfortunately, Ben, I think you hit it. Running a rice mill is very similar to running a farming operation. You've got cost on a per acre basis. We've got cost on a 100 weight of rough rice going through a rice mill. So it costs the same. It costs the same to run a high milling rough rice through a mill as it does a low milling rough rice. But the problem is you don't generate the same amount of revenue for that low milling rice that you run through. So Ben hit it. I mean, costs are higher and margin is squeezed significantly. And it makes it hard to generate that revenue needed to cover that cost.
So as we made it through the 24 harvest on the farm, I'm going to switch kind of to a farmer view here from the mills. But a lot of challenges last year. Prices went down during the growing season of all crops. Farmers had really good field yields on all crops in the 24 year. And as I heard someone say back last fall, was that the problems we're having weren't from poor management on the farm. It was mainly because of those dropping prices. Certainly didn't help, but we got through harvest. Everybody was kind of happy, you know. Then we started seeing that, gosh, those dollars weren't going to meet obligations on the farm. And farmers started kind of talking. Policy folks were listening, started going to DC some. I know Riceland was involved in a trip, I think was in early November, I believe, if that's correct, where a lot of the ag lending institutions in our country flew into DC along with ag lobbyists and policy folks like you guys, you know, that we talked about, the government affairs type people of all crops, and showed up in D.C. and really tried to explain to policymakers the economics of what was happening in farm country. So I think, Ben, I think you were on that trip. Tell us a little bit about how that trip was perceived, and then as the ball got rolling after that with some policy that came into effect later.
Well, I will, but I also want to give a shout out to Kevin and our chairman, Rich. I mean, you're absolutely right. And we'll talk about November in a moment. To be fair, our leadership saw the challenges that were on the horizon months before that. Kevin went up personally, so did our chairman. We were a bit of the canary in the coal mine, sticking our hand up early. And quite frankly, the momentum began to build over the course of the summer as other commodities began to exceed what we feared was coming our way. Others started seeing a lot of the same challenges, you know, and it's one thing for those of us in agriculture to express concern, but when the bankers get involved, more people pay attention. So we were able to form a great coalition to make the rounds, to hit those senators and congressmen that are on the committees of jurisdiction that were in a position to do something about it and to authorize the legislation. And we're very blessed, being from Arkansas, in the sense that Senator John Bozeman, at the time he was ranking member, he now serves as chairman of the Senate Ag Committee. So a leadership position last year, and even more so this, but during the course of last year, if we talk about November, he really championed our cause. We had the rest of our delegation that stepped up in support, but it takes more. We only have 6 members in the state of Arkansas. It takes more than that to get something through a Congress that has 535 members. We were able to team up with other commodity interests and lenders from really around the country and paint the picture of what the reality was and why we needed a Band-Aid. If they weren't going to pass long-term safety net legislation that was going to be sufficient to keep farmers viable, then we needed something in the short term. And out of that whole communication process was born what they call the ECAP program. Now, don't ask me to tell you what that stands for. I get lost in acronyms. But the short version is it's economic assistance that was short term and it was one time. And it's helped a lot of farmers bridge that gap and close out last year, pay off some debts, and better position them to get financing for this year. By no means was it enough for everybody, and it doesn't take the place of a true long-term viable safety net and policy that's in place. But it was rewarding to be part of a process where we were able to say, hey, what you're doing is not enough. You need to do more, and to see them react and deliver on those results. So that was positive.
Yeah, I'd go back again to that early fall period, probably before that November time. I was, of course, Riceland's a member of National Council of Farmer Cooperatives, so that brings a lot of different types of cooperatives together. And I can tell you, I found a friend when we started talking about economic assistance, Kevin Brinkley, who's CEO at Plains Cotton down in Texas. The cotton guys were seeing it early as well. And we started, because we still had hope for a farm bill at that point, right? So we started talking about a bridge, some type of bridge to get us to that new farm bill. We didn't want to say ad hoc, so we kind of liked that term bridge to get us to a new farm bill, and it caught on pretty quickly. So I definitely give that group credit for listening to Rice and Cotton and helping us get that ball rolling. But it was definitely early in the process.
Well, we don't have to get down in the minute-to-minute activities that were going on at the end during the continuing resolution, where this economic assistance actually finally did get plugged in and get passed. But it was satisfying that agriculture came together in this country and voiced the problem and talk to our policymakers, and those policymakers actually stood together in D.C. until this assistance, you know, was in that continuing resolution. We are seeing that those funds coming into farm country now just began maybe a week or so ago. And so I think it's really important from farmers and all of agriculture to be very appreciative and to let those policymakers know how much we do appreciate what they did for us and this money that's coming out. And it does not happen with one person or one group. It is a coalition, as you said. And farmers out there who might be listening who aren't talking to their legislators or senators and their congressmen, if you're not contributing to a pack of some kind of ag pack, there's a lot of them out there. If you're not giving and saying thank you, then I encourage you to do so, because I think it's really important to let them know that this has been a bridge. It is a bridge. It hadn't been the full amount of money and support, policy support that we need. So we're hoping for a farm bill. What are y'all hearing about a farm bill happening? What do you think? What do we need to do? How do farmers need to go forward? Can we be of any help to get it done?
Will they get something done? I guess September is going to be the answer to that as to whether or not we have to extend the existing one or if there's a new policy in place. There is, despite what you might believe watching the news, there's actually a process that Congress tries to go by. And so for all of these committees that have any type of activity that they're trying to pursue, there's an overall budget that they try to set. They try to operate on that, and that gives them spending limits on what they need to hit for savings targets or what they can actually spend on new initiatives. And when it comes to the Farm Bill, we're no different than any of those other initiatives. The chairman of the respective committees and that entire Ag Committee is anxiously awaiting the results of the budget debate. And I won't get into all of that. I'll just say that is bubbling brightly. I think as we speak here today, it appears the House may have even passed this. What the Senate, they may be coming to terms, and that may be coming more clear in the coming days. And so let's hope that does materialize here in the not too distant future. Once you get that top line number set and what those guideposts are, then everybody that has an interest in this legislation is going to be arguing over what the best way to spend it is. Nothing brings a good fight to the table like an argument over who gets the money. And that is going to be playing out over the coming weeks and likely months. And the question will be, can those committees come to consensus on how to divide the pie up in a way that ultimately gets enough votes for the House and the Senate to approve it before that September deadline. As I sit here today, I'm more optimistic than I've been in a while that something along those lines can happen, and we can have a farm bill that is clear, long term, and that is sufficient to provide the type of economic assistance that the farming community so desperately needs right now. But what would you add to that, Kevin?
Well, I think the things that I've been reading recently is, do we do a full farm bill process? Do we just raise those reference prices? Do we just improve crop insurance, make a few tweaks to the safety net, roll it into the big reconciliation bill and be done? Whether that gets political legs or not, I'm not sure. But again, when you listen to farmers about what's wrong with the farm bill, I mean, you know, we're talking about 12 titles in a farm bill, and really the only thing you hear about is Title I, right? We need those reference prices raised, and then we need some tweaks to crop insurance. So do we really need to do a full farm bill process, or do we just need to improve the safety net and move on? Whether that's part of the reconciliation process, we'll just have to wait and see.
Well, of course, from our viewpoint, the farm bill is about farming and agriculture and food security, which when you say food security, that encompasses what is actually the largest portion of the farm bill, which I don't, you know, some of my listeners may not be aware of all that's involved in there. And I can't tell you the numbers off the top of my head, so I'm going to lean on you guys to hopefully be able to tell me, like, how much of the farm bill is really nutrition and how much is going to what we consider farm?
So $1.2 to $1.3 trillion bill, and 85% of that is the nutrition title. And in that nutrition title, obviously that's food assistance, that's the SNAP program. So that's feeding hungry folks here in the United States, right? So it is the farm portion of the farm bill is actually the smallest part of the farm bill. And so that's what we've got to get focused on right here is to have that food for that nutrition title. We've got to have the men and women out there producing that food, and we've got to have a viable safety net to keep them in business.
Yeah, but you just said something that's important, Kevin, to have the food for the nutrition title. That's where we focus so much because all our members are farmers, right? We've got to have them be viable, and that's got to come together. But I do want to say, in case I know some of our members sometimes really exercised and even frustrated that we're spending anything on nutrition programs, but we won't get into that philosophical debate. But I would say from ag cooperatives' perspective, a lot of those feeding programs end up making markets for us as well. When you hear a nutrition title and there's a lot of money going there, that's not all necessarily a bad thing. It's helping to take care of a lot of those that are less fortunate. And ultimately, we're able to provide that food. I think the thing that we focus on first is we got to remain viable for that food to be there. And that's where our prioritization is.
Right. Well, it's just the farm bill is a big number, and it's kind of hard to even like see it in my head. That's so many zeros, right? I don't even know how many zeros a trillion is, you know? So it's a big number, but it's important, and it's certainly important for Arkansas and Arkansas's economy. Anyway, I am going to kind of move a little bit because we've been talking about a lot of serious stuff here, right? We're talking about terrible prices and farmers going out of business and no farm bill and all that kind of stuff. So I'm going to throw through a couple of things at you guys because I'm just curious to know offhand, if we play the music and you're walking out on the court right now, what is your walkout song that you would pick?
Well, if I'm walking out, Jennifer, what I'm walking out is I'm in my Chicago Cubs uniform. I have number 15 on. And I'm the starting shortstop for the Chicago Cubs. And the walkout music is Hank Williams Jr., A Country Boy Can Survive.
All right, Ben, can you top that one? Come on.
Man, no, I'm not even going to try, Jennifer.
You're not even going to try?
Great job. I'd just be playing off of his lead. That's too good.
That was a good one. I like that one.
It was good.
So how about Ben, what's a book that you've read that's influenced you, or maybe a fun book, you like to read? I don't know.
Yeah, it's very timely, especially with what our farmers are going through right now. There's a book that I tend to go back to and read from time to time. It's called Rising Tides by John Berry. If anybody takes my lead and follows my recommendation, they may get lost. Trust me, you need to get through the first 100 pages and get to the second part. At least that's what resonated with me. What Rising Tide is, it's really a history of all the various players involved in the flood of 1927, which was quite catastrophic to our area of the world. And the larger focus of that is the management of the overall Mississippi River and how our country was trying to tame an untamable force for decades, debating elements as to just how do you try to wrestle that Mississippi River to the ground and be able to utilize it for the transportation of goods around the world, but also recreation and keep it, quite frankly, from escaping its banks and flooding all our productive ag land from time to time. And anyways, you can tell I've looked at that one from time to time. There's an interesting aspect in all of it that I find interesting is that flood at the time, if you think about 1927, then had geopolitical impacts all across the country as it led to the migration of people from here to Chicago, to Detroit, to other places. And here we are 100 years later. I just reflect on how that flood had an impact on what the United States is today. We still face challenges with that Mississippi River, as Kevin knows all too well. In the course of a six-month period, the river's been too low. The drought's been too low, so we couldn't ship our product overseas. And just last week, we faced a new one. The river was too high and moving too fast. So we're still trying to tame the Mississippi River. Anyway, that's my answer.
Well, I think that's pretty timely. So I want to thank you both for being here with me today. I think we had a great discussion. I'm excited to see what 2025 brings for us. Any closing comments?
Well, Jennifer, I want to thank you for the invitation. And again, I would just tell farmers out there, just hang in there, right? We know better days are on the way. We're in a tough spot, and we're all in this boat together. And just because the storm is here doesn't mean we're not on the right path. It means we just got to persevere and push through. And I believe that's what all farmer-owned cooperatives are trying to do, is press on. So we're pressing on.
Great words, Kevin. All I'd say is thanks for having us on. The opportunity to share a little bit more about this co-op that we love, and just add thank you for what you're doing with media like this and others. We appreciate your role in the industry. So thank you.
Yep. Well, enjoyed it. Thanks for being here. This is Jennifer James with Field Good Life, and I'll see you in the field.